today. How a mole in a far-right organisation helped foil a plot to kill an MP, resulting last week in a life sentence. And an unlikely collaboration between a Guardian columnist and the legendary techno group Underworld. What did you think of immigrants?
Hated them. Hated them with a passion. I hated the sight of them. I hated the sound of them. Because every time I saw somebody with a non-white face, I believed that person was stealing from me. I believed that person would stop me getting a job. That person might stop me getting an operation on the NHS. And I was, you know, I was just of the opinion that they didn't belong here.
This is a story about young men rising through the ranks of violent, far-right, racist groups. Men like Matthew Collins, who was a prominent member of the National Front in the 1980s.
Growing up in South East London with three brothers, living on a council estate, grew up sort of in the shadow of the National Front. A lot of times people talk about how people get their heads turned or people get groomed by these groups, but I went in with eyes wide open. When I did find them, I joined immediately because I wanted to belong to this group who looked like me, talked like me, and thought and felt like me. I felt at home, I felt at place, and I felt justified. And that was the first time in my young life where I'd ever felt I'd belonged to something.
But it's also a story about second chances.
And what changed?
I changed.
Matthew did not just renounce his own bigotry. He went on to become a key anti-fascist campaigner. Nearly three decades after leading the National Front, he found himself at the centre of a story that had echoes of his own past. Running a secret informant inside one of Britain's most dangerous far-right groups and foiling a plot to murder a member of parliament.
He bought a so-called Gladius machete, similar to this one, and described online as offering 19 inches of unprecedented piercing and slashing power.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, taking on fascism from within. I'd like to start with a warning. In this episode, we talk about individuals with extreme and offensive views, and there are descriptions of violence.
I was employed full-time by the National Front eventually. They asked me to quit my job and go and work for them, and I worked in their head office. And I, you know, I saw basically the way that that worked. And then there was a moment of extreme violence where I went to a public meeting and I witnessed my colleagues, my friends, my peers behave in a way that I thought would... Well, in a way that I just, you know... I saw them beating people up and I just thought, I really don't want to be involved in this anymore. I can't do this. You know, I really, really can't do this anymore. And, you know, that was the moment when I began to then question everything. Once I'd seen that extreme violence, that horrific violence, everything I saw and everything I heard, I began questioning. So it was like my tipping point, something that might have tipped me in very, very slowly, but it tipped me out very, very quickly.
Was it hard to get out?
I stayed inside and gave information to anti-fascist researchers, people who worked on undermining the group, people who would sort of help educate you or people that would help improve you as a person, people that would help open your eyes. I spent, I think it was 3 years, carrying on this facade of being a fascist when all the time I was desperately trying to get out, but also desperately trying to understand myself. Where do I fit in society now? What do I know about immigrants? What do I know about migrants? What do I really know about Jews? I knew absolutely nothing. And that was a daunting process.
Matthew finally left the group in 1993. His life was under immediate threat, and he was flown out of the country by Special Branch and into hiding in Australia. Eventually, he returned to the UK, and since then, he's dedicated his life to fighting fascism, with the organisation Searchlight, and now as Hope Not Hate's head of intelligence.
Since then, the Hope Not Hate campaign has worked with local anti-fascist groups to enable and provide a positive alternative to the politics of hate.
In those jobs, Matthew has organised networks of infiltrators and informants, turning people inside far-right organisations and trying to bring them down from within. Most recently, he has turned his attention to a neo-Nazi organisation called National Action.
Robbie, in 2015, you wanted to join National Action, and you said you shared some of the views of people in that group. What type of views did you share?
Anti-immigration views and concerns about grooming gangs and that sort of thing.
This is Robbie Mullin, who joined National Action in 2015 at the age of 21.
Where I grew up in Widnes, it's 99% white. So when I used to go to other places working, different towns like Blackburn, Bradford, it was a big culture shock.
And did it make you angry?
Not angry, no. I just didn't want my town to turn like that, to look like that.
And how did you come across them? How did you first find out about them?
I seen them online, and I also attended National Front demonstrations, and I come across National Action members there. And then I met up with them the following Saturday, and then I did for the next 2 years. They didn't look like the general far right, which was fat old white men, but they were all young.
And so you found you had more in common with them? You could hang out with them?
Yeah.
Matthew, at the time, you were head of intelligence at Hope Not Hate. What did you know about National Action?
They were very, very sophisticated. They were very, very security conscious. And they were also, I think, other than just an ordinary youth group of young neo-Nazis, they were very, very into their culture. They developed a culture around hatred, around violence, around Nazism, but also other things about, you know, Satanism, sexual violence, violence against women as a weapon, rape as a weapon. We were surprised, if not shocked, just how extreme and how dedicated they were to violence. It became like a death cult towards the end. Every time National Action went out, it was like a pantomime. They were very into the theatrics. They were like a neo-Nazi Boy Scout group. They all had to dress the same.
Do you remember examples of that type of thing happening when you were there, Robbie?
Yeah. It'd just be like a Darlington and Berwick upon Tweed, where you'd have the usual far right in front of us all with the cans of Stella in their hand, and then we were all uniformed and in order behind them. We'd be dressed in all black.
And what sort of things would you be shouting?
Britain is ours, the rest must go.
So, what did the organisation actually do on a day-to-day basis?
We met every Saturday in Warrington in the Friar Pencroff pub. And we used to go to the gym in Warrington, training.
Training for what?
For this inevitable race war, which the group's in.
You're going to the gym once a week, you're training for a race war. What was it you were hoping to achieve? What did you think you were going to do?
Well, I think everyone believed that the group could achieve its aims, which was a free white Britain. There'd be a lot of boxing training. There'd be some training with Cali sticks, which is a Filipino fighting stick, and there'd be some knife training.
Robbie and the rest of National Action were meeting up and discussing these horrendous ideas, and were doing so relatively under the radar and with relatively few people paying attention. But then the MP, Joe Cox, was murdered by a far-right terrorist.
Just before 1 o'clock today, Joe Cox, MP for Batley and Spenborough, was attacked in Market Street, Birstall. I am now very sad to have to report that she has died as a result of her injuries.
Her murder had nothing to do with National Action, but their members celebrated it, with some even tweeting support for her killer. These tweets were spotted by the authorities, and that led to the group being proscribed as a terrorist organisation under the Terrorism Act, which you might think would bring a pretty swift end to their activities.
Within days of the ban coming into effect, they just regrouped. And that's when our work became very, very important, because we knew that they would never stop. But the impression was that they had stopped.
Robbie, can you remember a moment when you thought, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, I think it was around the Joe Cox killing, when they were tweeting it, and I knew that it was never going to end well. there's a little bit in your head when you're listening to him talk that it's fantasy, and there's people with shared views and everything they're talking about that you believe a little bit is fantasy. And then when Joe Cox was killed, it was a lot more real, and there was a lot in the group which was, if he can just walk up and kill her in the street, why can't we?
Do you remember when you decided to contact Matthew?
That was in April 2017.
Matthew, why do you think Robbie came to you?
It's a very difficult group to leave. It was like a cult, like a disease. It was an addiction. And he wasn't in a position where he could just get up and walk away. And I think also perhaps he recognised he was very, very dependent on that group, I think, socially and politically. And he saw the work that I'd done, he'd seen the work that I'd done, he'd seen about my past, and he wanted to get out. And send him an email, I see that as his cry for help.
Knowing what you did about getting out of the National Front, were you scared for Robbie when he called you?
No, because Robbie was in my hands. Our aim is to obviously undermine and disrupt the extreme far right in this country, stop people terrorising, killing and murdering people on the basis of their colour, sex, religion, anything like that. If someone like Robbie comes to help us do that and undermine them, we owe them a debt.
How did you feel, Robbie? Were you scared?
No, never.
Never scared?
No, never will be. Never have been.
Matthew, can you just describe the process of recruiting a mole in a far-right group like this? I mean, do you have to check that they're not trying to infiltrate your organisation?
Of course. In Robbie's case, he came to us, so then we set a process up so we could check who he was. We'd never heard of him. When we brought Robbie to London for our first initial meeting, we used a lot of security. And when he got his train from Liverpool into London, we put two people on the train to sit near him just to make sure, you know, he wasn't talking to his comrades or meeting anybody with a view to doing us any harm.
And so once you were convinced that Robbie was someone you could trust, you started to meet regularly and in secrecy.
So it was a question of me travelling to the north or Robbie travelling to the south to meet up, or we'd meet somewhere elsewhere in the country, away from where people would know who we were, and Robbie would pass information. But the other process with, in Robbie's case, was that we wanted to socialise him. You know, he's spoken about living in Widnes, and it was 99% white, and then he travelled to Blackburn and Bradford, and he was horrified or shocked by what he saw. Part of that is introducing him into new ideas, new environments, meeting new people. Our idea was that Robbie would leave National Action and we would write a big blog or a magazine article about National Action exposed, and nobody would ever know Robbie Mullen existed. It didn't pan out like that because it turned into a murder plot.
It was July 2017, and Robbie, now working as a mole for Hope Not Hate, was in the Warrington pub where key figures from National Action met every week. The leader, Chris Lithgow, was there, his close associate Matthew Hankinson, and a 22-year-old called Jack Renshaw.
Instead, we let these parasites live among us, and they still do. They get into our councils.
He was known for his vile, racist, and anti-Semitic views, and was already being investigated for hate crimes and child sexual offences.
We were sat outside because it was a nice sunny day at the time in Warrington, and then once Jack did arrive, which was quite late at night, about 7 o'clock, it started raining. So Jack told us he had something he wanted to speak about and to come inside. So we went to the usual table in the upstairs, the Friar Penker, which is a round table in the window. And we sat around, and Jack basically told us that he planned to kill his local MP and the police officer who was investigating him at the time.
What did you think when he said that?
I couldn't, like, get my head around it in a way. When he said he was going to kill his local MP, I asked him who it was, and he said Rosie Cooper, and everyone round the table was, who was that?
I was to be murdered to send a message to the state, to send a message to this place. Members of this house are regularly abused and attacked.
And then Matthew Hankins said, what about a synagogue? And I said, there might be, but there probably will be children there. And Jack said, it doesn't really matter because they're the same as rats. You don't class a rat, a baby rat, as a baby rat. It's all just vermin.
Did you try and talk him out of it there?
No. I just asked him, was he sure that he knew what he was doing? And he said that he was sure and he was 100% going to kill Rosie Cooper on the following week.
And what I find absolutely extraordinary is this isn't like a secret location where you're having a private conversation. You are sitting in a Wetherspoons discussing the murder of an MP with somebody throwing in, well, why not go to a synagogue instead? I mean, was that normal for National Action?
Well, obviously, a murder plot like this wouldn't have been every week, but yeah, we'd speak about genocide every week in the pub and no one would bat an eyelid.
And by this point, you're in touch with Matthew. What do you do in the pub then and there?
I knew that I could message Matthew and he'd do something to stop it. And I texted Matthew the second I could.
I was on my biannual holiday. I got up and I rang him at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was the second day of our holiday, I think. And from then the wheels went into motion and my holiday was ruined. I rang my boss, the chief executive of Hope Not Hate, Nick Lowles, and then he rang Ruth Smeath MP, and then the two of them went to see the police to get some security around Rosie Cooper and also to arrest Jack Renshaw.
Police found a 19-inch Gladius machete, a Roman short sword, in Renshaw's flat. He had bought it to carry out the murders. More details of Renshaw's plan emerged later. First, he would kill Rosie Cooper and then take a number of hostages. Then he would lure a female detective who was investigating him to the scene. He would kill her as well. After that, he would commit what he called suicide by cop, by advancing on armed police wearing a fake suicide vest. Renshaw's arrest prevented any of this from happening. But it wasn't over for Robbie Mullin. He stayed in the group for a further 3 months as his lawyers tried to negotiate a deal. Immunity from prosecution for his cooperation in bringing other members of the group to justice.
On September the 27th, 11 people were arrested by the counter-terrorism police in relation to membership and also the plot to murder the MP and the police officer.
Although the arrests were the product of two separate investigations, they're all part of a national operation against suspected National Action supporters by counter-terrorism police.
I woke up in the morning, it was all over the news that there'd been arrests around the northwest. Robbie and I spoke to each other very, very early that morning. He was waiting to be arrested because he thought the police would come and arrest him, at least to, you know, maybe help disguise the fact that he'd been giving information to us and that he was likely to give evidence at court. And then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Robbie rang and said, the police have been to my house and given me an Osman warning, which means that there is a credible threat to your life. The police are aware of a credible threat. Someone's going to murder you. And then because Robbie had refused to go into their custody and their care and wanted to remain in Hope Not Hate's care, the police then drove off and left him.
For the last defense.
Coming forward down the left-hand side for United.
I left London and made my way to Manchester so I could get picked up and driven to Robbie's home. Manchester United were on the radio. It was dark. I've never seen rain like it. It was almost tropical the way it was hammering down. We went to the house where Robbie was living. He put all his worldly goods into a sports bag. He came out, got in the back of the car. We drove around Runcorn in this horrific weather. It was very, very dark. And then we pushed him into another car at Runcorn train station and drove him off into the night.
Do you remember how Robbie seemed in the car?
I think he was nervous. I think he was concerned. I think also, as you would be, he was wondering where he's going. And I guess it, for the first time in his life, his whole life was in someone else's hands. He didn't really have much control over it.
What has happened to your life?
Well, it's been a mad 2 years. It's been a strange 2 years.
What's changed?
where I live, what I do, everything in life's changed.
Have you lost your job?
That was long gone, yeah. That was gone on the 27th of September.
Have there been any more Osman warnings more recently?
About 2-3 weeks ago.
You had another threat to your life?
Yeah.
Matthew, when you were talking about your work with Robbie, it wasn't just about finding out about Jack Renshaw. It sounded like it was also about trying to de-radicalise him. And I suppose one thing I want to understand is, has that process worked?
I think we've managed to get Robbie to a position where any concerns or fears or disagreements he has with society, he can articulate them more progressively. I think he's developed an understanding about communities, he's developed an understanding about people. The example we probably can't go into was on holiday.
Do you go on holiday together now?
No, goodness no, my missus wouldn't allow that. he had an incident on holiday which I think he dealt with very, very admirably in terms of having to confront a racist.
Robbie, tell me what happened on holiday.
It was, we went in a restaurant and he said that the little Indian kids were little packy animals or something like that. So I pulled him up on it and told him to shut up, basically.
Matthew, has National Action been completely disbanded?
The people who formed the organisation and created the organisation are still active. National Action might be finished, but its ideas and its former adherents are still out and still active.
Matthew, Robbie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Matthew Collins and Robbie Mullin telling an extraordinary story. Last week, Jack Renshaw, who is now 23, was sentenced to life in prison with a minimum term of 20 years. Christopher Lithgow and Matthew Hankinson are both also behind bars, serving 8- and 6-year sentences. You can read more about the case at theguardian.com. Coming up, remember this. How on earth did Aditya Chakraborty end up collaborating with Underworld? Now, I love this. Somehow, Guardian columnist Aditya Chakraborty has taken a break from writing about economics to write lyrics for the legendary techno group Underworld.
The bread and butter of what I do is looking at numbers. For my reporting, I'll often go to light industrial estates or housing estates. And then every once in a while, you do something totally out of body. It was 3 weeks before last Christmas, and this email just suddenly turned up in my inbox, and it was from the publicist for Underworld, the techno duo. My bet is that pretty much everyone listening to this will know Underworld, even if they don't think they do, because they're the ones who soundtrack the end of Trainspotting, the movie, who do that tune that goes lager, 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 lager. And they were looking for people to chip in lists of ideas or people or places. And he'd seen my series, The Alternatives, from last year, which was all about economic and political and social alternatives to Britain's failed model. Now, Underworld and I go way back, unbeknownst to them. Because when I was a teenager, I used to save up money from my Saturday job, and theirs were among the first 12 inches that I bought. And so I thought, all right, I'm just going to give myself 10 minutes, bash down a load of things, and then just fire it off. In the middle of last week, I suddenly found myself out in deepest North Essex, kind of farmland, down a dirt track, in a converted pig shed, which is now Underworld HQ. And I'm facing two guys, some of whose records I know extremely well, and they're playing what sounds to me like a classic Underworld tune, and it's got my words over it. It's bubbling along. I'm hearing worker co-ops, employee-owned, procuring organic food. And then you hear Whitney Granby Rochdale Preston. And that becomes the chorus over this absolute banger of a track. I put down four places that to me are really valuable. Whitney, because there the town council and other people have got involved in fighting austerity by running their own community bus scheme, where otherwise there would be none. I put down Preston, where the city council have led a kind of fight back against Britain's failed economic model and have really tried to branch out with all kinds of different economic experiments. Granby in Liverpool, which has got the most amazing resident-led housing programme. And in Rochdale, which is the kind of historic centre of the English cooperative movement. I think you can probably tell how surprised I was and how delighted I was. There's a normal strangeness that is going to be familiar to anyone who's ever heard their own voice on tape. But then you've got someone else's voice, who you know very well, Carl Hyde, and now he's singing my own words back to me. I'm obviously really chuffed because these are things I really believe in. I'm not saying it's definitely, but there's a small possibility. It might make you just wonder, what are they going on about? And go and look it up for yourself, just as Rick Smith did when he had a list in front of him. And just as I did, crucially, when I used to listen to music as a teenager, and you know, I used to get records and I used to look at the lyrics that were sometimes printed on the inside of the album cover. And I used to wonder, what are they on about? I had no expectations whatsoever. I mean, how many daft PR inquiries do you think Guardian journalists get on an average day? Like, I can tell you loads, right? The very possibility that 5 months later, I'd have my name on a record that's on Spotify and all the various other streaming platforms. No, it's completely not in my normal span of activities.
That was Aditya Chakraborty. He's made it. Do listen to the full track on our website. I'd also like to point you in the direction of our previous episode called Poverty in Britain, A Social Calamity. It followed the UN Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston, on part of his tour of the UK. Yesterday, Alston's report was published, comparing conservative welfare policies to the creation of 19th century workhouses. That's all for today. My thanks to Matthew Collins, Robbie Cullen, Aditya Chakraborty, and Underworld. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly, Rachel Humphreys, Claudia Stobart, and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.